Nelson Poynter believed that local news organizations ought to be owned in their local communities. And he said, so the only way I can guarantee doing that is I got to put this out of the hands of the heirs. He said, well, but still, they're your heirs. And he responded to that by saying, I've never met my great-grandchildren, and I'm not sure I'd like them. And it has preserved the local ownership in Tampa Bay of this news organization and its independence.
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation.
Joining me on SPX today is the president of the Poynter Institute, Neil Brown. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Joe. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Let's start with, as you are on the front lines of all things journalism, let's start with your State of the Union for journalism.
Journalism is thriving, actually, and I think it's time that we move a little bit away from a perpetual narrative of lament and talk more about how journalism organizations, small, medium, and large, all kinds of platforms, maybe even some new definitions of journalism, are serving communities all over the country, including here in Tampa Bay and in Florida. And I think that sometimes this sort of frustration about the sort of noise on cable TV and certainly challenges in the economic environment create kind of this kind of narrative of journalism is dying. It's not. There's challenges to it for sure, but there are also really interesting new experimental forms going on. Audiences are finding new ways to get information. They care about, the citizens care about information, quality information. And so it's a wonderfully exciting, complicated, at times difficult, but often more vibrant than you sometimes get that sense from people.
Makes a lot of sense. And there's, you know, a couple elements, sort of different lanes within which journalism has struggled and is emerging out of that. One of the ones I'd love to hear your take on is almost, I'll say, another State of the Union question. What's the State of the Union for objectivity?
Objectivity is a great conversation piece right now. And sometimes we find that, well, nobody can really be objective. So maybe a better word is neutrality or nonpartisanship, and not thinking that we don't bring our own viewpoints, occasionally even biases, experiences to the equation of journalism. So the question is, have you pursued the information that constitutes journalism in a neutral way that makes the reporter open to whatever the story brings as opposed to a predisposition toward it? And so whether objectivity is the right word or whether that's an old-fashioned word, I don't know. We really think that good journalism is independent, and the pursuit of the information starts from a position of neutrality to go after wherever the facts take you.
And do you think that with the advent, you know, you think of, you mentioned objectivity being maybe an outdated term. You know, one of the things with the advent of the internet is it's bloomed expertise, some of it real, some of it imagined. But, you know, for the most part, if you're into, you know, left-handed butterflies, you can go find, 100 hours of content on about them. And with that, what has emerged is deeply held and, well-articulated stances from certain perspectives, right? So you think like offshore drilling, which there's a deeply held stance on why that's bad for the environment or it's a risk. There's a deeply held stance on why that's great for tax dollars and great for corporations. And there's some elements of truth in each of those perspectives. And so, you know, along those lines of looking at the modern idea of objectivity, how much of it is potentially blending different perspectives?
You know, I think you make a great point about the sort of fragmented nature of how we get information. If we were on video, you'd see me hold up my phone and say, you know, with this device, everybody can be a publisher, right? And you hear that all the time. That's true. But you know what? This device does not make everybody a journalist. And the difference between journalism and just disseminating information, whatever your passions, whatever your advocacies are, that's one thing. But journalism is something completely different. And that does require that level, at least independent journalism, that requires that level of neutrality, of welcoming a variety of positions, of putting them forward, of transparency about who you are and where you come from in ways that maybe very niche sort of topic lines don't feel the obligation to, or maybe we don't need to. I'm a big baseball fan. I'm a big Cubs fan. I'll go to MLB.com and it's the Cubs channel, right? So I'm hoping I'm going to get a pretty smart, neutral take on my favorite baseball team, but I also simply know where I'm getting it, right? And I can make that judgment. And if I want some other takes, I got to go to some other places. So topically oriented information isn't necessarily just journalism,
right?
And journalism can be topically oriented. So look, you take arts, people who cover performing arts, they're experts in their field, and it's a very narrow niche. And that can provide real information, including criticism, which is going to seem like it was biased.
Right.
So now we blend these things together. And I think that's okay, rather than these sort of very sort of strict, rigid definitions of what constitutes useful information. I think the key is I just need to know who you are, where it's coming from, and how you got it.
Sure.
And then I, as an audience member, I get to decide after that.
And with that example, a couple actually interesting threads to pull there. But with that example of the art, the critique of the art and that expertise, does that shrink the viable lanes that the standard journalist can play in because they can't have that expertise by the nature of their job? They're doing a story a day or a couple stories a week. I mean, does that change the nature of what journalists can effectively cover?
Well, you know, it's a funny. You raise a great question. Here's the thing: journalism used to strive on being generalists who became informed. Well, now generalists doesn't get it done for a lot of people. They want the expertise. They want to know where you get it from, and they want to know, you know, why you came up with your opinions if you are an expert, and they want to know what your credentials are. But what you're describing is this tension that has happened, particularly as we have sort of chased every eyeball, where being a generalist gets you a lot of traffic, but it gets you very little expertise, even less. And with less and less expertise, you become less and less valuable, and then the eyeballs actually go down. So we've got this weird dynamic in an information age where it's moving at such speed. And like you said, so many journalists are going after so many different things and doing none of them particularly well. And then the audience is saying, you know what? My time is tight. I think I'm just going to go with a few experts that I like.
Yeah.
So we have a real tension point.
And, you know, the other thing I thought was interesting when you use the Cubs example, because everybody can be a publisher, but not a journalist, you know, typically that means they're going to publish things that appeal to them in a way that appeals to them, but that's also going to appeal to the people who choose to listen to them, you know, self-select in by sort of definition of that bias. And so I wonder, you know, would it be a fair example to say that comparing journalism to biased publisher, you know, influencer type pieces would be the equivalent of you trying to go to the MLB site for the White Sox to get your, you know, to get your Cubs news? I mean, it wouldn't feel as good, right?
No, it definitely would. You understand this tension.
Yes.
I applaud that. You're onto something. It contributes to the feedback loop if you're into that same expertise. Now, maybe that baseball analogy wasn't perfect because, you know, as a sports fan, people like to debate. And in a lot of our political news, people actually don't like to debate. They only want validation of things that they already believe. So I do think, and you see this in your own website and things like that, that creating a community of interest is a good way to sort of say, and hopefully on a civil level, Let's kick this around. Let's debate it. I will say in you know, some of these sports sites, you will see some people mixing it up. Yeah. And maybe that's the healthier thing if you can, again, do that in a civil way. That's been a little harder in the political space. So I don't think just a niche thing means feedback loop. But it can. And it certainly can in the space of the political environment we're in right now, where things are so polarized and people only want validation of what they already know. I do know, and as a baseball fan or sports fan of anything, people do like to mix it up, like, no, he should start, he shouldn't start, that type of thing. And so I do think that there is an opportunity for journalism to be not just the public square, but sort of the place where we could debate this stuff. Let's just see if we can figure out how to debate it a little bit more civilly than sometimes happens.
Yeah. Well, a couple more threads there that, you know, the first one, I wonder, you know, when you talk about the identity piece of it, right? And to some extent, our knowledge, the amount of information available has grown at a way that we as a species just haven't been capable of keeping up with, right? And within one generation had infinite information available to us, right? So it seems somewhat natural that you would look to distillers of that, right? You know, people who you trust, who you think are looking into these things, that you can just say, you know, I like the way this person thinks, whatever they say, I'm good with. But that came at a time when social media also came up, and, you know, a lot of those folks had, you know, financial or ideological reasons to go heavy in one direction. And so therefore, you know, people follow them down that rabbit hole, and you get into this weird spot where, because of that, they almost can't pull out a piece of it. It's like almost an all or nothing thing because their identity is so wrapped up into it. They can't pull a piece out of it, or they'd be essentially, you know, disloyal to that sort of identity they've partnered themselves with.
I think your example is a real good one, and probably let's start with, because I think it gets under discussed, the financial incentives, which I think are problematic and go to that lack of transparency. Everything from cable TV, just say, when you watch CNN, and I'm not here just to pick on CNN, but when you watch CNN and they have a panel of seven pundits, and they don't really disclose that every one of those people are being paid. Now, we know what their political biases are, but what we don't know is that they're being paid, and guess what? They're not getting invited back on unless they're provocative. So that what they may have to say is in fact clouded a little bit by the financial dynamics around it, as opposed to the quality of the information around it. This is not unique to CNN. It happens everywhere. But I think whether it's on social media, television, I mean, you name it, that we think about political bias, obviously, but I think that there's financial incentives. We certainly know that misinformation pays on the internet, people making a bundle off of it, and without any accountability for it. So I think there needs to be a lot more conversation about how can we be more transparent about the financial components that are underpinning these opinions or this news. Again, I think we should respect audiences to at some point be able to discern for themselves, but they can also be forgiven if, well, I had no idea, and so they saw things through a different prism.
Yeah, and that financial incentive, you mentioned publisher versus journalist. Every one of those publishers is financially incentivized to attack and devalue the journalism to put themselves on the same playing field. This is fake news. This is not, you know, and therefore what I say is more real. And marketers are savvy and they're effective. And, you know, we've learned how to just tweak the colors exactly right to get a desired effect, you know, and tweak the words exactly right. And it's become a science. And it's, you know, it's easy to see why a lot of people go for it.
There's money in playing with those dials. There's no doubt about it. And that's what they're doing. They're playing with our emotional dials, the information dials, and there's a financial payoff to it. I don't think we sound naive by decrying that, but we just need a lot more openness about it so people can understand what it is they're seeing and whether they're being manipulated or not.
Yeah. And you have a vehicle in PolitiFact, and I think there's actually a PolitiPundit or a
PunditFact.
PunditFact, yeah,
yeah,
thanks.
Exactly.
You know, and so you started at Poynter in 2017, acquired PolitiFact. Poynter, it was started at the Times, but then acquired by Poynter in 2018. Can you kind of walk us through that acquisition, why that happened, and sort of how you ingested that.
Sure. I mean, it's a fairly passionate and shameless effort. I was there at the beginning at the Times. I helped start PolitiFact in 2007. So when I left the newspaper to go over to Pointer, which we own the paper, I sought to take it with me because two things were true. It was extremely popular. That's great. But it was also a national play. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that the financial wherewithal of the local newspaper to support a national product was pretty limited, and that we would need to invest both in the user experience, in more reporters, in taking PolitiFact even more nationally. And so the Tampa Bay Times was just not in a position to support it. What's more, because it was a national play, we saw membership and philanthropy as part of its business model. Mm-hmm. And to make it easier on the fans of PolitiFact, so that if they made a donation, it was tax deductible, we needed to move it over to the nonprofit Pointer Institute.
Right.
So part of it is just, it's a passion project for me. I've been involved since the beginning. And we just also thought that PolitiFact, which was in a huge growth mode, needed tech and financial support that only Pointer could provide, not the Tampa Bay Times. As you know, if you watch it, Tampa Bay Times gets to run PolitiFact. Mm-hmm. It's still part of the family.
Yep.
We get to run the PolitiFact stories in the newspaper all the time and on its website. But it continues to grow, PolitiFact. When I brought it over in 2018 to Pointer, was probably a staff of six. Now it's a staff of about 15.
Nice.
And we're in multiple states, and we're doing all kinds of great work that only being part of a national nonprofit can make happen.
That's great. So essentially, you're happy with it. I mean,
are you kidding? It's roaring. And of course, in 2024, obviously, every election year, it's bigger and better. One of the biggest developments subsequent to moving it from the Times to Pointer was we are part of a program called the Third Party Fact Checking Program. We're one of five in the U.S., and then there's about more than 100 organizations internationally that fact check information stories. I'll even use the word crap on Facebook Meta.
Yeah.
We're paid by Meta to do this, and all the fact checkers are. And what it is Meta's effort to at least try to slow down the spread of bad information. So there is a queue full of Meta Facebook posts of political information, and fact checkers are paid to check them. And when we find that they're false or pants on fire, as we like to say, PolitiFact, we tag them as such, and they get downgraded within the social media channel. It's a drop in the bucket against the ton of misinformation that's out there. But Meta understood that, we can't be responsible for every single post that's out there. And so among the big organizations that do this work and get paid to do it are the AP, Reuters, USA Today, PolitiFact, factcheck.org, and as I said, in more than 100 other countries, there's fact checkers. Now, here's the nature of both transparency and potential conflict. We fact check it, we get paid by Meta, and Meta pays us enough that it also bankrolls other fact checking by us. Mm. So we decide that's a calculation we're willing to do, as long as everybody knows it's upfront. There's no censorship on the part of, they never tell us what we can fact check or what we have to rate anything. But they do pay us fee for service for the service, and that throws off enough money that we can do lots more fact checking of other material.
Give us an idea of the scale of active and intentional misinformation. You said it was just a drop in the bucket. What you can check? Can you articulate what the scale of this stuff is?
Well, just what I'll tell you is we probably fact check, 125 different Facebook claims in a month, just PolitiFact. Mm-hmm. There's probably 500,000 fact checks.
Wow.
I mean, things you could be fact checked.
Right, right.
So we're just one of our, again, it's all around the globe. So there's just a lot of stuff out there. Some of it's true, a lot of it's not.
Yeah.
But I still feel like anybody who winds up seeing something or a relative passed something along, you should see this, but now you see that it's been downgraded and now you as a consumer have some whiff that this may or may not be true, or where does it come from? We're helping.
Right. So, and that leads me to want to sort of throw out a couple sentences around free speech and get your opinion of them. So obviously, you know, Elon's big on free speech, and while he doesn't censor, you know, they have their some terms and services stuff about, you know, really off color stuff, but they will downgrade, right? Which is the same word you used. They'll kick it down the algorithm. So it's it, nobody right. sees it, but the person and their mom essentially.
Or fewer
right?
see it.
Fewer see it. Yeah. You know, we at The Catalyst have been moderating our comments from day one. We did this as an experiment. You know, I do this because my belief is while technically social media offers a platform for free speech, the culture of social media with the toxicity and the trolls and whatever actually makes it in reality a place where only a certain tranche of people actually use it, and then they therefore dominate it. And so, you know, but believing in free speech, we didn't want to mess with ideas. So we moderate for civility. So you can say, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. But you have to say it in a civil way that doesn't shut down the conversation, because that to me is one of the greatest crimes of social media. So, you know, given the active disinformation, given that, you know, even the folks who advocate free speech as fervently as Elon does still do things to essentially bring, make sure stuff doesn't see the light of day. You know, and then the whole concept of, you know, sort of my theory on who actually uses social, and actually it does preclude people who we should want to hear their voices from participating. You know, where do you think free speech should play when it comes to all the, you know, the vehicles that are out there for people to talk through?
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely one of the most tricky and interesting and complicated issues of our day. It really is. So hate speech, for instance. I mean, like you said, you're moderating for civility. Well, that's really appropriate. I mean, it's an ugly, ugly environment out there. And your brand is at risk, if, in my opinion, if you don't do what you can to assure that civil and appropriate, I don't know,
environment,
right? Yeah. So that's different than censorship, right? And what happens is censorship is a flag that's waved very quickly
when
somebody doesn't like the judgment made about their material.
Absolutely.
And there's a couple of things I would say to that. One, and from a journalism and even a fact-checking standpoint of our job isn't to be popular, mm-hmm. right? So again, our big phrase at PolitiFact and at Pointers, show your math. Here's why we downgraded it. Here's what the problem was with it. Don't just take it down without explanation. Don't just downgrade it without explanation. Here's what the facts show. Here's the language that was used, which was hate speech. And that's sort of why. That's one thing. Two, back to the volume of material versus what we can comment on it. We're not limiting anything. We're making judgments about, in the case of PolitiFact, about what's relevant and what may be being spread and whether there's a consequence for it. And again, whether there's a transparency around it. We show all of that. There are still tons of stuff we're not even touching. So this notion that any one journalistic organization or journalist specifically can somehow be part of a censorship regime, as it's sometimes called, it's usually because you didn't like the verdict, right?
Yep.
So I think we just have to be willing to take some heat. We have to show, again, show our work, show where we come from. Don't say... I think you have to be judged on those things over the course of a period of time, not at any one constant moment. You didn't like this story, yeah, but over the course of, you know, people say like, well, who have you fact-checked the most? The answer is Obama, mm-hmm. then Trump. Now, Trump will catch up. Mm-hmm. And that's just because of power. These are the people in power.
All right.
Right, you know? So we just need to not just buy into the narrative that if you're against me, you're against me.
Right.
And explain to our audiences. And then ultimately, the audience gets to decide for themselves. This has value for you? Fantastic. If it doesn't, we accept that, move on to something else.
So you started at the Congressional Quarterly way back when.
Actually, my first job in journalism was the Miami Herald.
Yes. I'm actually going to Mr. Pointer.
I never met Nelson Pointer. He was long dead before I ever joined the company.
Oh. All right. Let's talk about the idea then. So, you know, obviously the family has been, yes. is still around and there's right. the trust.
So Nelson Pointer did found Congressional Quarterly where I went to work. Yep. And that's where I met Paul Tash, who was the Washington bureau chief for the St. Pete Times at the time. We were all in the same building in Washington, D.C. But Nelson Pointer and his wife, Henrietta, started Congressional Quarterly in 1945. And the idea there was they thought back then that the people of St. Petersburg, where they own the newspaper also, the St. Petersburg Times, needed to find out how the members of Congress from their area were voting. And they had there was no internet. They didn't have any really easy way to do that. They could, obviously they had news, but nobody was literally counting every vote that they ever did. So they just started a service and they would just track the votes of people who were in the House or in the Senate in Washington for their audiences back here in St. Pete and Florida overall. And it grew into this, and so it was a quarterly little list of voting. And it grew into a weekly magazine covering Congress. And then ironically, constantly, Nelson Pointer was a visionary. Ahead of his time, he understood like, you know what, quality information, you should charge a lot. Not a little, a lot. And they were able to get lobbyists who had a lot of money
right.
to buy subscriptions to Congressional Quarterly for several thousand a year yeah. because these folks needed the information because it was key to their business.
Yeah, the Bloomberg terminal.
Exactly. It was ahead of the Bloomberg terminal. It was that very kind of thing.
Same idea.
You got it exactly right.
Yeah.
So my experience was I went from the Miami Herald and I went to Congressional Quarterly where I was in charge of features about Congress, and then I became the managing editor there and then came to St. Pete to join the St. Pete Times.
That's great. Tell me about working with Paul Tash.
Paul remains chairman of the Institute to this day, and he hired me in 93, so you do the math. That's me saying like I can't do math, but I've worked with him for over 30 years, 35 years probably, and great guy. He came up through the chairs. He did know. He worked under Nelson Pointer when Paul was an intern here. I think of Paul as synonymous with Tampa Bay journalism, and he, carrying on the tradition of his predecessors, believed that this area, this region, could be passionate about local news, but have the aspiration of a global news organization. And so he was able to help this organization run with both local commitment and national and international ambition. And that's a good combo. And I think we try to do that even at Pointer. So he helped grow the Tampa Bay Times into the largest news organization in the state, which it stays that way today.
Yeah.
And Pointer could be more proud to own it. All of it is built around Nelson Pointer's incredible vision in the 1930s and 40s when he bought the St. Petersburg Times from his father. And then over time, he feared that the newspaper business that he loved so much and that was so lucrative for him, for himself, and for other families around the country, that someday the heirs won't want to be in the journalism business. They're going to want to cash out. So ahead of Nelson Pointer's death, 3 years, in fact, ahead of him, he created a school then called the Modern Media Institute. It was in a little bank building on Central Avenue right next to the Emerald Bar, which is still there. If you go to the Emerald, I do sometimes. So right next there, he created a school. And the idea was it's going to do professional development, training for professional journalists, photography, make your stories better, ethics, because he felt that news organizations around the country weren't investing enough in training. They were just so busy doing the work, they weren't training their folks. That's all great. But he had this dream, and he announced it ahead of his death, that when he died, instead of leaving the St. Petersburg Times, which was, again, a very profitable, worth several hundred million dollars, instead of leaving it to his heirs, when he died, upon his death, the ownership would go to that institute, now called the Pointer Institute, was called the Modern Media Institute. And people would say, what are you doing? Why are you leaving this? Why don't you leave it to your heirs? And he said, well, there's two things. One, I'm very worried that someday local news companies will fall into the hands of chain corporate owners who don't live locally, because the heirs are going to want to cash out and they're going to sell to big companies. And Nelson Pointer believed that local news organizations ought to be owned in their local communities. And he said, so the only way I can guarantee doing that is I got to put this out of the hands of the heirs. He said, well, but still, they're your heirs. And he supposedly responded to that by saying, look, I've never met my great-grandchildren, and I'm not sure I'd like them. And so upon his death in 1978, the ownership of the Tampa Bay Times, now Tampa Bay Times, used to be St. Pete Times, fell to the school. And it's unique in the world of American journalism to this day. And it has preserved the local ownership in Tampa Bay of this news organization and its independence.
And that was prescient on a couple levels. I mean, obviously chains were buying them, but even now with the decline, a lot of these sort of vulture VC firms are coming in, scooping them up and stripping them down. So, you know, he's protected from that. So as I understand it, the Times cannot be sold, essentially. So, or what are the restrictions around the trust that it's in?
Ultimately, Mr. Pointer said one other thing. I think he was asked by Jack Knight, who ran Knight Ritter at the time, how are you going to guarantee that this paper doesn't fall into the hands of chain ownership? And Nelson Pointer supposedly said, well, at some point you do have to trust somebody. And in his case, he trusted a guy named Eugene Patterson, who was a legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning editor, who was the editor of the St. Pete Times, and he put the entire voting share of stock in Patterson's hands. Patterson passed that down to a guy named Andy Barnes. So we have a board of directors and a board of trustees at Pointer, and the chairman is the only person who can vote the stock. So first it was Patterson after Pointer. Patterson put it in the hands of Andy Barnes. Barnes put it in the hands of Tash, and to this day, Tash has it. So at some point, there's no ultimate guarantee, except the will, the Nelson Pointer's intentions are very well known. And there was, in fact, a hostile takeover attempt in the early 90s. And we beat that back by making sure that all the shares were consolidated in the hands now at Pointer. So is there an ultimate bulletproof guarantee? No, but it is held up now for 50 years. And there's no sign of that abating.
And, you know, being a business guy and competitive, I wish I could have been a fly on the wall. The Tampa Tribune made this sort of now legendary, they called a meeting, didn't tell anybody why. Again, maybe this is just the story, but, and then, you know, basically Paul walked out and sort of like, here I am. Do you remember that?
I was there.
Tell me how that rolled.
So a couple of things for context. So keep in mind that Media General, longtime owner of the Tampa Tribune, and did write by the Tampa Tribune for years, and the Tampa Tribune was a very good newspaper, sold the paper to a couple of those VC guys you described, a guy named Robert Laurie, I guess his name. And that the Tribune was in a cut mode, as we all were, because as you can look around the country, it's unfortunate, but pretty much no metropolitan area can sustain more than one metropolitan newspaper. That's just the nature of the business model in an internet age with so many choices, like we talked earlier in the program. And so the only way to survive was for this market to be consolidated in the hands of one news organization. For the longest time, antitrust and trademark issues kept that from happening. We tried a few times to acquire the Tribune. Media General didn't want to sell. And then Media General sold all their properties to Warren Buffett, all their newspaper properties, because Warren Buffett loved newspapers. Except Buffett said, I'll take them all except for one. This is true. He would not take the Tampa Tribune. And the reason was he knew that there was such a strong competitor across the way, and it did not make sense. It wasn't super personal against the Tampa Tribune, but he knew that every other market only had one, and the larger paper was the St. Petersburg Times, and he was not going to take on the Times as a competitor. You get to be Warren Buffett and a billionaire by making smart judgments. So that then ended up in the hand of those two investors, or the investment group that I mentioned. So they started cutting it and cutting it. And we started to, we got some opinions, and we were able to get the name of our own organization changed to include the Tampa Bay Times. That's a much longer story for another podcast, but great battle for the trademark name. And it was clear there was only going to be one surviving news organization. And with all due respect to the great audiences in Tampa and the Tampa Tribune, it was not going to be the Tampa Tribune. They were not investing. They were shrinking. We were the place to go. To obtain the financing needed to buy the Tribune, we needed to be in as strong a competitive situation as possible. And at both the counsel of our lawyers and our investors, that needed to become one paper quickly. And so the judgment was made, painful and difficult, that, and you saw this in other markets as well, that as soon as you go and you obtain the one asset, you got to close it. Could we have done that after a day or two? That's what I think a lot of folks were saying. We should have given people a chance to say goodbye. The strong counsel from our investors was we couldn't take a business risk of anything going wrong here. We needed to close it instantly. So Paul and I and two others went over there. It was a painful day. We kept some of the staff that we could keep. We were more generous than the previous owners of the Tribune were in terms of severance going forward. And we had to make the difficult decision to close it down quickly. And so I'm sure for any individual, they might not have seen it coming, but everybody saw it coming. So it's one of those just difficult things. And I say that with profound respect. We kept some really talented people. Mm-hmm. TBO, which was their the digital site for the Tribune, was in fact turned out to be one of the most important assets we acquired. So the Tampa Tribune's work to go in the digital space was a strong component in the acquisition.
And how did you decide when, in that if it was shrinking, Buffett had rejected it, these guys were cutting, why not let it just follow its trajectory downward for longer?
Sure, because from an advertising standpoint, it was becoming a war of attrition. The more both sides were taking from each other, first of all, both companies were losing money.
Right.
That was not sustainable from an investment standpoint. And for the longest time, those guys wouldn't sell. And when they said they were going to sell, you had to jump. Yeah. It was just, it made the most business sense for the future of a news organization in Tampa Bay. At some point, a war of attrition isn't where you want to be, where you're right. Both race to the bottom.
And, you know, I'm thinking through the timing. I guess you joined Pointer in 2017. And when did Paul step down? What, 3 years ago? Four?
No. Not quite two, I think.
Not quite two. Okay.
So I think it'll be two in June.
Okay. I guess it's, yeah. You know, why did you want the Pointer job?
So people joke and say it's a Dick Cheney story. I was on the search committee to replace my predecessor. And a guy named Tim Franklin, who had gone to take a job at Northwestern University. And I knew Tim. I'd been part of Pointer governance in some tangential ways, and I'd been coming there for a long time and always admired everything that Pointer was doing. And I was part of the family. But I was on the search committee, and as I probed more about what we were looking for and seeing where journalism was struggling, the PolitiFact opportunity to grow that, to figure out how to come up with some new and interesting answers for local news, it became more and more interesting to me as a possible opportunity for something new. And keep in mind, I had been managing editor and the editor of the St. Pete Times, Tampa Bay Times, for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's a longer run than most in that thing. So I was interested in trying something that kept me within the family, but kept me something new. And so I helped, and particularly bringing PolitiFact along with it made it a great opportunity for me personally. And it's been total honor to work with everybody at Pointer. And we hit the timing right. So at Pointer, where we support local news, we've gone into the media literacy space with a program we call MediaWise, which is helping people discern fact from fiction online, everywhere from middle-agers to senior citizens. We've expanded fact-checking not just through PolitiFact, but with the International Fact Check Network. We went to you mentioned Craigslist. We went to Craig Newmark and got a major gift to create an ethics center, $5 million. And I'm a real big believer in the future of local news as I started this very podcast saying, like, let's not lament, let's go for it. So when I got to Pointer in 2017, we were 32 full-time staffers all here in Florida. Today we're at 82 staffers in 12 states in the District of Columbia.
So it's you're a business guy now. You're productizing things, and that's a big change. Sounds like fun.
And it's been a blast. And I think that journalism and entrepreneurship, as you well know, Joe, they are not in collision. In fact, it's all about service to a marketplace. Serve them with a lot of different kinds of products. That is compatible with journalism, and that's what we're trying to do at Pointer as well.
Well, enjoyed the conversation. We covered a lot of ground, and it's always fun to watch all the energy and action that comes out of Pointer. It's just, you know, just putting stuff out into the universe nonstop, and it's always good stuff. So congrats.
Well,
on that.
I appreciate the chance to be with you, and congratulations on everything you're doing here. It's very exciting. There are so many organizations like yours popping up in cities all over the country trying to serve markets in new and different ways. And that's exciting.
Neil Brown, Pointer Institute.
Thank you.